So lecture three, we're going to whiz through a number of topics here, which are listed up here, and there's going to be half a dozen slides on each. So the first subject is gravity anomalies. And in the last lecture, we talked about how you made various corrections. You go out and you measure the data in the field, and then you have to do things like correct it for how far north you are, correct it for your height, you have to correct it for this curious grey slab concept, and you have to correct it for terrain, and so on and so forth. So how do you go about doing that, and what does that tell you when you've corrected it? Well, there are essentially two what we call anomalies. This word anomaly is kind of a bit misused. I mean, it typically means something that's different from the average. So you do something like seismic tomography, and you see some region where the wave speed is faster than it is on average, and you call that an anomaly. Well, it's a little bit the same in gravity, except there are two different kinds of anomalies, because what your background is, well, that's not necessarily very well defined. But you just have to remember two of these things. And one is called the Bugue anomaly, and the other is called the free air anomaly. So the Bugue anomaly, conceptually, this represents everything above sea level, steamrolled down to sea level, and you get the gravity field of that. That's the free air anomaly. The Bugue anomaly represents everything above sea level and bulldozed away. So the number you get should be what you would measure for gravity if you had gotten rid of all the topography and you'd just taken that measurement at sea level. And it's expressed by this equation here. So the Bugue anomaly is what you'd measure out in the field, so that might be at the top of a high mountain, you know, somewhere far north, minus the latitude correction. This is the latitude correction, so you first made the latitude correction. You've corrected for the fact that you're on a high mountain, you've corrected for the fact that you've got this thick slab of rock underneath you, and you've made the terrain correction. So this is the Bugue anomaly, and in theory, as I say, if you steamrolled away all the topography and you got yourself down to sea level at that point, this is the gravity that you would measure. But the other kind of anomaly, the free air anomaly, represents squishing everything down to sea level, to a sort of infinitesimally thin layer, and then taking your gravity measurement. So the free air anomaly is essentially giving you some sort of gravity anomaly which represents the integrated mass beneath you without correcting away the mountains and the valleys and so forth. And as you can see, this is much simpler. You just have to make the latitude correction. You just have to make the correction for the fact that your observation point was way above sea level, and that's it. You don't correct for the Bugue slab or the terrain. You just leave those in. Typically, we deal with the Bugue anomaly if we've done a gravity survey on land, and we deal with the free air anomaly if the gravity survey is done at sea. So mostly what you'll be looking at is Bugue anomalies. So switching to another subject, and that's isostasy. That's the second one on the list. Isostasy is the study of how loads, such as mountain belts, are compensated for at depth. And this was first studied as far back as 1740, when scientists went to the Andes with a plumb bob, so everything was quite primitive then, and they reckoned, they made a rough estimate of the mass of the Andes mountain chain, and they reckoned that if they set up a plumb bob like this, and instead of falling, sort of hanging exactly vertical, it would be slightly attracted up by the Andes like that, and they calculated what this angle should be. But when they went there and measured it, they found the angle was much less than they'd calculated. And it was less to an extent that it could just simply be error. So they suggested, the idea was suggested that this huge mountain chain, this enormous weight sitting on the surface of the Earth, was compensated underneath in a similar way to Archimedes' principle. If you float something such as a ship on the surface, then a lot of it will sink down into the water. It will displace a sufficient amount of water to keep it afloat. So this is the experiment, really, which gave people the idea that the Earth was viscous inside, that the Earth could flow inside like a liquid. And a couple of centuries later, when Wegener came up with his continental drift hypothesis, nobody wanted to believe that these huge continents could move. That was just sounded like craziness. So his continental drift hypothesis was not well taken, but there was one person who was very broadly read and understood the Earth very well and realised that the Earth was viscous inside and thought that these continents could perhaps float on this viscous layer, and that was Arthur Holmes, who founded this geology department and who gives his name to the Student Geology Club. So, a little bit of history for you there. People also observed it in the Himalaya. So when they first made this observation, being good scientists, instead of saying, oh, this proves X, they immediately went out to check it. They checked the Himalaya and got the same answer. So this gave rise to the concept of the lithosphere and the asthenosphere. So the lithosphere is the rigid part, and the asthenosphere is the viscous part underneath that the lithosphere can sink into. So here we have a summary of this, and some of these words tend to get bandied about and people don't fully understand them. So I've put in a little explanation in this lecture. So we think that the lithosphere is strong and brittle, and this is equivalent to the plate, or you know, the tectonic plate that's floating around, if you like. And then you have what's known as the depth of isostatic compensation. That's quite a good expression to remember, the depth of isostatic compensation. And underneath, you've got the asthenosphere. And this depth of isostatic compensation, this is probably a gradational boundary. It's not just a really big chart underneath the asthenosphere. The lithosphere may be something like 100 kilometres thick. It's a bit thinner near mid-ocean ridges, but under the continents, under cratons, it may be 200 kilometres thick. Under normal continent, perhaps 100. Under the ocean floor, it depends on how old the ocean is, how cold it is. This is the crust and mantle, and this is a completely different pair of layers, which are useless to divide up the Earth. So the crust is much thinner than the lithosphere. The crust is not equivalent to the lithosphere. The crust might be 10 kilometres thick, 20 kilometres thick, something like this. Its maximum thickness is under mountain belts where it's up to 50 or 60 kilometres thick. And its base is a seismological interface. So if you do a seismic experiment, you find that there's a sudden jump in the P wave velocity at that boundary, and that marks the base of the crust. And underneath we have the mantle. So you can readily see that some of the lithosphere, the lower part of the lithosphere, is mantle material. Of course, we think of the crust as the silicic part of the Earth, the Earth, and the mantle as being largely peridotite. So the lithosphere is going to be the crust and part of the mantle. The mantle lithosphere is thought to be very old, thought to be kind of stuck onto the bottom of the continental crust there, and to have been there essentially from, you know, right at the beginning when the Earth first got itself organised. So that's very old material here, and there's quite a lot of speculation about its chemical composition. So just remember that the lithosphere and the asthenosphere are defined rheologically. They're defined by the lithosphere being brittle and the asthenosphere being viscous and flowing. And the crust and mantle, these are seismic subdivisions. So, how is this isostatic compensation brought about? How is it that these mountain chains are actually in equilibrium? They adjust their height to make themselves in gravitational equilibrium. Well, there are two theories again, so this is a lecture of twos. There's the so-called Pratt theory, and Pratt suggested that the different compensation was the same everywhere, and the different blocks had got different densities. So where the mountain stood up high, Pratt suggested that the density was low, high mountain, and where the deep valley or some low region, Pratt suggested that the density of that particular block was high. So I know this theory here predicts that this equation should hold, where rho is the density, h is the height of these blocks that you see here now. That h is the height of the block above sea level, and d is a constant. D is the depth of compensation. So the other theory is called the Airy theory. Airy suggested that this was not the case, that the density varied laterally. The density was in fact more or less the same everywhere, but if you had a high mountain somewhere, then you had a deep root compensating it. So. This theory suggests a variable depth of compensation, obviously, and there again, this would be the relevant equation, so those of you who are interested can check that out and see if you agree with that equation. In fact, people have studied this, and they find that the two different theories are correct in different places. So here we have an example of Airy compensation, where we've got the ocean here and a mountain chain along the edge, and the mountain chain does indeed have a deep root. But there are other places where we do see variations in density laterally. So it's not a question that one is right and one is wrong, but the two different theories may be correct in different settings. Okay, densities. Now this is quite an important subject, and occasionally there's a whole exam question set just on densities. Because when you're doing gravity surveying, if you get your density wrong, everything else will be wrong. Now I'm going to describe seven ways of getting rock densities. So everybody should know what those seven ways are. And we're going to do a little calculation here in class, so I hope you've got your calculators handy. I used to give a prize to the first person to get the right answer, but I haven't got any prizes with me. So we just have to do it for the love of it. So just a little bit of a preamble to begin with. Density varies rather little in the Earth. It only varies from about 1500 to about 4500 kilograms per meter cubed. Just a factor of two or three. So it's one of the parameters in the Earth which varies the least. We're used to thinking in geophysics of things that vary over many orders of magnitude. So for example, earthquake magnitudes, you could have a -2 or a -3 sized earthquake, or you could have a -9 earthquake. So if you express this in terms of Newton meters, which is the correct way of expressing the size of an earthquake, then you find that the size of an earthquake varies by 30 orders of magnitude when expressed in Newton meters. So density increases with age, with depth of compaction, and with basicity. So granite, for example, is less dense than basalt. And it's quite important to get good densities. Although it varies rather little, it makes quite a big difference to the answer that you get, especially if you're trying to estimate tonnage, for example. Your boss is not going to be very pleased if you have made a factor of two error in your estimate of tonnage. Here are just a few examples that I took from a textbook. So here we have basic igneous rocks, density 2.79 in CGS units, that's 2,790 meters per cubic, kilograms per cubic meter. Metamorphic rocks, dolomite, granite, limestone, shale, sandstone. So the sedimentary rocks, the less well consolidated sedimentary rocks, have got the lowest density, and sediment, unconsolidated surface sediment, that have a low density, and basic igneous rocks, high density. So, seven ways of measuring density. So, you've decided to do a gravity survey for your project. You've gone to the Vale of Eden, or you've gone to Ardna Merkan, or some really nice place. to know the density of the material above sea level. You're going to calculate the Bouguer anomaly, which means essentially correcting away everything above sea level. In order to do that, you need to know the density of the stuff above sea level. Then what you obtain when you do your gravity modelling is a picture of the density of the density variations of the material below sea level. But to start with, you need the density of the rocks above sea level. So one thing you can do is to take some samples. Take your rock hammer along, take a few samples, bring them back to the lab, and you weigh them in air, and you weigh them in water. So you can easily do this with a pair of bathroom scales, or kitchen scales, depending on how big your sample is. So, obviously weighing it, you suspend it on a ring like this, put it in a beaker with water and weigh it while it's submerged. So, here we have an example. We've done this. We've weighed the sample in air and we've found that it weighs 1 kilogram, and we've weighed it in water and it weighs 0.6 kilograms, so what is its density, everybody?
If you think you've got the answer, you can call it out. Well done.
2.5 kilograms per cubic meter. Now, did anyone else get that answer and was too sort of embarrassed to say? This is your homework, everybody. There's going to be another question just like this one next week. And we're going to carry on doing these questions until everybody understands how to do it. So you could try going and talk to this guy who's got the right answer. charge 50p for every time you explain it to somebody. It's very, 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 very simple. I think you did it in your head, didn't you? So think about it, everybody. Okay, method number 2. I'll stop torturing you at this point. Method number 2, using a borehole gravimeter. So obviously if you've done your gravity survey somewhere, then you're not in a position to sink a borehole, so you'll have to do a little bit of research and see if anybody else has sunk a borehole. Somebody's done some fracking or something or other like this, and there are some data from your field area that you can use. So here's another thing that you math wizards can look into. What's done with a borehole gravimeter is to measure gravity at 2 heights in the well. So here we have this grey band, which is a formation of rock. Gravity has been measured at this point here, and gravity has been measured at this point here. And the difference between the gravity at the top and the gravity at the bottom is the free air correction minus twice the Bouguer term. So the Bouguer term is 2 g rho h, and here we've got 4 g rho h. And the reason we've got twice the Bouguer term is because when you're measuring up here, this slab of rock is exerting a downward pull, and when you're measuring here, it's exerting an upward pull. So you have to correct double. So everybody should think about this. Check that you agree with that equation. Because if you answer an exam question on this this subject. It's not enough just to sort of regurgitate this. You've got to show evidence that you understood why this is correct. Okay, the gravity, the borehole gravimeter is in fact the most accurate way of logging a well for density, but it's not the only way. Another way is to use a special density logger which contains a radioactive source in it, often cobalt 60. So the little cobalt 60 source that's down here, and there's a Geiger counter here, and the idea is that the radiation is transmitted into the rock here, and it's scattered and goes back to the gamma rays go back to the Geiger counter and are counted there, and this can be translated into density. This is really just empirically calibrated thing, so it doesn't give you any kind of, it's not like the borehole gravimeter where actually you're on firm mathematical grounds. You just have to do a sort of run with this somewhere where you know the densities and empirically calibrate it. But it does have its disadvantages. For one thing, it's held against the edge of the borehole with this spring here. But although this looks like a very nice borehole, boreholes don't actually look like that on the inside, because boreholes, instead of being nice straight tubes like this, they're just, they've got edges like this, okay? Because when you drill, you pump water down, circulate the water around, and the water comes back up again, flushing out all the cuttings. And this water tends to eat into soft formations, so you get a lot of water erosion from the borehole, but the walls of the borehole are not straight. So sometimes this thing is not pinned firmly against the edges of the borehole. Sometimes there are zones where rock is actually missing. And furthermore, the gamma rays are only sampling a few centimetres, 10 or 15 centimetres into the rock. They're not sampling the whole formation. Whereas, of course, the borehole gravimeter, that's sensitive to the whole wide formation. It's only looking at 15 centimetres that's been all messed up by the drilling anyway. This is quite a cute method, and this is one to think about when you're actually in the field doing your field work, because you can get the density of the surface layer just by doing a little extra bit of gravity work. And what you do is you find a knoll, you find a little hump somewhere that you think is representative of the material above sea level. So you don't want to take something that's a volcanic plug and it's obviously different from everything else around about it. You want to take an erosional feature. And you do a little gravity survey over it. And then when you get back to the lab, you reduce the data using lots of different densities. And the idea is that if you use the correct density, then you should just get a flat result. If you use two higher density, you'll get something that looks inversely like the topography, and if you use too low a density, you'll still be able to see the topography in your result. So this is known as Nettleton's method. Smart students, when they do their gravity surveys and work out their results, they use as many of these seven different ways as possible to get density. So here's another little mathematical challenge. You can get density even if you have no other information, just simply from your gravity data. Here we have the Bugue anomaly equation, your observed gravity minus the latitude, the Fourier correction, and then you've got the Bugue correction and the terrain correction, which contain density in them. And you can rearrange this equation so that you've got a y equals mx plus c type equation, where m, the gradient, is density. So you can rearrange it so that you've got an equation which is linear with the gradient of the line being density. And here I've labelled the axes with this amount. What you get here is g observed minus g latitude plus Fourier correction on the y-axis, and 0.04191 h minus the terrain correction divided by 2000 here. actually come across that before, so added it into this lecture for your benefit. Okay, so supposing you know you're really pretty stuck and you've done these and maybe they haven't worked too well, or maybe you've not been in a position to get very much data. You might be doing a gravity survey in a desert or something, and there's no topography and you can't get a reasonable rock sample, and there are no boreholes, so you might be a little bit stuck. Well, density has been empirically related to seismic velocity, so if there have been some seismic surveys there, you can use that to get an estimate of density. This is known as using the Nave-Drake curve, and the Nave-Drake curve is shown to you here. So somebody has taken lots and lots of seismic measurements and they've plotted up P velocity in kilometers per second against density, kilograms per cubic meter, and got something like this. So you know, you look to see what seismic surveys there were, you'd say, well, you know, the velocity was 4 in my field area, so that would give you an estimate of about 2,200, something like this. That might be the best thing that you could do. Unfortunately, this graph is a little bit misleading, because if you actually look at the data that are plotted, you see a tremendous scatter about like this. So that's 2,200 plus or minus 300 probably, so it's not going to give you a very accurate answer. So it is not desirable to have to fall back on this. And it's even less desirable to fall back on number 7, which is simply looking up your rock type in a table. So you can easily find tables like this, density of sediments, 1.7 to 2.3, sandstone 2 to 2.6, shale 2 to 2.7, a huge range here. So this is not what you want to do, but there might be occasions when it's the best you can do, or it's good enough to make a rough back of the envelope calculation just for interim purposes. So there are 7 of those methods. Make sure that you can remember what those 7 are. Those of you who feel inclined, see if you can rearrange the Bouguer equation and get that graph that I showed. And get your heads together, talk to your colleagues who are taking physics, and see if you can figure out how to get the density of a sample by weighing it in air and water. And you might even like to try it out for yourselves if you've got a kitchen scale. College cleaners will love that, won't they, if they find kitchens full of water and rocks.
You can even try it out experimentally yourself to see if it works. So we'll finish off the lecture with an example. And the example is an area of sulfur exploration in Texas. In this area, gravity was found to be the most cost-effective way of exploring. Things like seismic and other methods may be much more expensive. It's possible to design gravity surveys so that you cover quite large areas quite inexpensively, especially if you use an intelligent strategy. So, you know, your boss might come to you and say, okay, you know, we need to survey this area, which is 100 kilometres on a side. We think there may be sulphur reserves there. I want you to design a cost-effective strategy and come up with a budget. You might be told to do that. So if you're smart, you might think, well, let's do a rough reconnaissance first. Let's measure a point, say, every 10 kilometres on a grid, a rough reconnaissance, to see if we can pinpoint areas that might be more interesting than other areas. And then we could target our resources on those particular areas. And this is what was done. Okay, so the dominant lithologies in this area were limestone and dolomite and sands and gypsum and anhydrite. So you'd obviously want to look up the densities of those. You might want to sleuth around and see if there was any outcrop, or you might want to get samples from boreholes or samples from previous excavations to try to get these densities. And then you might do a reconnaissance like this with points
rather widely separated. You might identify areas of particular interest where you saw some particularly high readings or low readings. So here we have a Bouguer anomaly, which has been obtained from all these points. And then you might want to go in and do a more detailed survey like this, densifying in places of particular interest. This is what was done. So the reconnaissance was done at a rate of one station per square kilometre, and the detailed survey was done at a rate of 10 stations per square kilometre. Okay, then a big part of this project was determining the densities, and I've given you the URL that you can visit on the web there to look at more detail of this example. So a lot of effort was put into determining the density, because that kind of maps immediately into, you know, maps directly into your estimate of the reserves in this mineral prospect. So the density of drill cuttings and cores were measured. Maybe they were weighed in air and water, and the density was calculated. Borehole logs, neutron borehole logs were used. Gamma-gamma logs, which is the logging tool that I told you about, and also borehole gravimeter measurements. So in some cases, you know, it might be worth suggesting to your boss, well, we should really sink a borehole here, and we think that excavatable resources might be in the upper, say, 300 metres, and if we sink a borehole, then that's going to cost $50,000, and it'll give us this, and you would budget it all up. So here is so-called Prospect B. This is the gravity anomaly. It was obtained for this area here, and a transect was drawn across it like this, and then the people and the geophysicists then proceeded to model that cross-section. This is quite a good example of what a borehole neutron log looks like. So this thin line here is the measurement of density using the borehole logger. And you can see that it dips to zero, so we've got density across here, 2.2 to 3. So it's not exactly dipping to zero, but it's dipping down to 2.2 here and up here. So as you go down the borehole, the density measured is varying by a tremendous lot. And that's not because there are different thin beds with different densities in this borehole. It's because of these washout zones that I told you about before. So if this region has got salt and other soft minerals like that, then obviously if you drill the well and you circulate the water around, you're probably going to make a lot of erosion in the walls of the borehole. So what's been done is to draw a line down here, a line down the maxima, if you like. So this is the maximum density. It's density increasing across the top. So at these points here, that's where the maximum density was estimated. And somebody has just drawn a line down the maximum densities and said, well, this is spurious reading because it was a washout zone. So this is the actual density. So this is how this borehole log was interpreted. And then when all this work had been done, some kind of model was set up in a computer. Okay, so you've calculated your Bouguer anomaly, and the observed Bouguer anomaly is this dashed line. This is the observed Bouguer anomaly. You've made all the corrections, free air correction, etc., etc. You've got this line here. And then you've gone to a computer and defined some sort of model for the body that you think is causing this gravity anomaly. And in this particular case, a kind of cone-shaped body has been set up here. So this would have been based on previous geological knowledge of other bodies of this sort and different densities. So this block here has got a density of 2.6, 2.7, 2.76, 2.8, seems to be 2.5, so there's a density inversion there. And the computer will calculate the gravity effect of all these little component parts of your theoretical body, and it will give you a printout result which shows you the sum total of all of those gravity anomalies, and the objective, of course, is to try and fit your observed know from the practicals that if we changed the density of one of these blocks, supposing we made the density lower and the size of the block bigger, you'd get the same result. This is the ambiguity problem. And this is why it's important to try to get as accurate a density as possible so that you can pin that down, because you cannot distinguish between the density and the size of the body just from gravity alone. There's an ambiguity there and a trade-off. So, let's finish the lecture there, and let me see now, it's 9:44. So, at 10:05, I'll brief you on the practical, and in the meantime, you can have a 10-minute break.